Hello everyone, can you hear me fine? Alright, I'm George, here we have Dimitri and Saeed. So today we're going to share with you guys how we use Apache Graph to build serverless multi-tenant Lua engine service that powers workflow processing at Netflix. Some quick introduction of our group. So we are the Media Cloud Engineering Group. So you know at Netflix, right, so we focus a lot on the movie production and also about streaming side, but you really cannot take the movie from camera directly sell the user. So couple issues, right, the movie is too large and you need to add your branding, it's audios, languages, right, all these had to be processed before you deliver to the user. And you have many users, they have different devices, right? So you really cannot have one stream that serve everybody. So our team, MCE, they make these connections. So we build a platform to support media transformation and the media innovations at scale for Netflix. So more specifically, we focus areas like efficient cloud computing, right? We do a lot of very media-heavy computation like encoding, right, assembly, packaging. All this is very time-consuming, so it takes hours to run. So any improvement, small improvement in the efficiency of your computation, you reduce a lot on the cost. Another important area is the secure storage, right? So we spend millions of dollars to invest in one movie. What if that movie got leaked during the process of this transformation? It's huge damage to your investment, right? So this is the second area. So we also focus a lot on the production side. So as you know, you probably cannot imagine as of today that studios still use a lot of manual processes for their movie productions. A lot of things they do it manually. So what we do is we build a lot of toolings to support them to modernize their processes, to streamline their productions. Another very important area is about media processing workflows. As you know, we have many movies to support, right? So all of them go through various stages or various different kind of transformations, like video encoding, audio encoding, text, right, images. So we have a lot of many different workflows need to handle. So all these are really very interesting topics. If you have interest, definitely come to talk to us after talk. So today's agenda, I will walk you through about media processing workflows. We'll talk about what it is about and how we build it. Then Dimitri will talk more about the service architecture, how do we build such kind of platform to support all these various kind of workflows. Then Saeed will talk more about how we leverage Graph to support such kind of workflows. So you can imagine a media workflow media processing workflow start with getting a raw media file just from the camera, right? So we needed to do a lot of operations. Imagine we have 150 million, more than 150 million users, right? All of them have different devices, and you need to generate streams that fit all these different devices. They require different bit rates or video audios. So there's a lot of processing to go on. Then how do you orchestrate them, right? How do you generate these streams? So one simple example can be like, you get a raw media file, right? Then you do some inspections, like figure out what is the video container format, what kind of audio it is supported, and how many channels it is inside. Then based on this input information, you can decide what kind of transformation I can do. Then go through a series of steps of transformations to generate final media that can be consumed by the devices. So here's a more concrete example, right? In this example, we get Stranger Things from the studio, right? Then they deliver it to us. But they attach some requirements. You have to produce the final streams in a couple hours, for example. So to speed things up, we have to do chunking. We divide the video into many, many small chunks. So in this example, we divide the video into 30-second chunk and with 200 chunks. So this kind of in theory, we can do 200 times faster than if we do it in serial. Right. So all the chunks get encoded concurrently. When they are done, then we put them together, go through an assembly step. Right. Then the assembled video go further, goes through a packaging step that has some encryption information there, so any user can consume them securely. So before we dive into kind of more detail about how we structure the service, I want to talk about some challenges we are facing while developing such service from aspects like scalability, operation-wide, and the developer productivity point of view. From scalability point of view, we have 100 workflows, like video encoding workflow. If you want to further divide by different codec type, you can divide your workflow much smaller, so they are more focused. And you can have audio workflow, right? Audio, they can also have different codec optimizations. So it all depends kind of how larger your workflow becomes, then you decide what still need to divide further down. So you become a lot of microservices. Each workflow is a microservice. So we have many, many workflows to manage. And these workflows, they invoke media-heavy competitions like remote function calls, or you can call another services, right? So all these are kind of triggering many, many competitions in the cloud. At peak time, we like have 100 of thousands of CPUs we have to run. And to automatically scale up and down all these instances is really a daunting task. From operation side, we want to make all this workflow operation follow the CI/CD pattern. Right? This means we have many, many build jobs and many, many pipelines we have to manage. And monitoring and get alerts ready for such larger system is not easy. Another very interesting aspect is about request tracing and debugging. Right? So imagine if when a request went through a larger system with many components or many layers of components, it's extremely powerful or helpful if you can visualize what is going on with this request and what kind of steps it went through, how much time it takes at various stages. Especially when the error happens, you want to easily to know at which endpoint and why it is failing. You don't want to dig through the logs for hours and figure it out. You want to easily to figure out, hey, this is a red bug, I need to see it. Right, so this is extremely helpful to have the tooling along that. From developer productivity point of view, I want to kind of emphasize one thing is at Netflix side, right? So we kind of as a platform team, we build tooling to enable these workflows, right? And our developers are really kind of the video or audio expert. They know how to do the algorithms stuff, right? So they really don't have much interest kind of to, or they're not, it's not the best use of them to kind of operate the network, right? Operate the instances, do this monitoring work. So they really want to focus their very kind of expert side, the domain knowledge is about algorithms, about encodings. So what we do is we want to enable kind of to make them more efficiently writing these kind of workflow high level logic. We let them express it. Under this condition, you want to run encode A, and another condition, you probably want to invoke another service. So we let them to express this kind of workflow logic in very high level DSL languages. So we want to make the function calls easy, right? All the function calls in our system is abstract as an interface. So it can be a remote function call that invokes encode, or can be a gRPC call to another component. But from our developer point of view, everything is just looks like local function. And they are strongly typed in the rule. So they're the same signature of the kind of remote function or service running at another component, just as if it's running locally. And you can test them, just mock it, and make your test very easy. You don't have to worry about integration test. You just test at an interface level. So this high-level DSL is really, really powerful to abstract out all this boilerplate code. So our developer don't have to worry about how do I send the request? How do I receive these responses? Right? They don't have to worry about how do they persist the data. We automate all this persistence for them. When the workflow runs, they just know I have some match condition. When it happens, this function going to run. And when this function finishes, they will get some response come back. They just need write code to handle this response. So we also automate the dependencies, so they don't have to worry about, hey, how do I build OSGI bundles? How do I decide which package should I include in my code and that's not available in your runtime? So we automate all these things. They don't have to worry about this dependency management. All they are focusing on this high-level description of this workflow logic. So next, I'm going to pass Dimitri. He will talk more about details, how the service is architectured.
Okay. So I'm going to talk a little bit about basically how a workflow service looks like and introduce like where Caraf is and why is it here. And what are some of the reasons that we pick Caraf to build this platform. So this is pretty much how a typical workflow looks like. There is an API. What it does is it just accepts a request from a user to do some work, for instance, encode a video. So, and then the API is also responsible for communicating back response upon the completion of the request to the user. So this part is pretty much very straightforward, and it's a gRPC application, and it runs on Spring Boot, and it's not interesting. So the next one, the API basically, what it does, upon the request, it just sends an event to a rule engine, and then the rule engine picks it up and starts processing. The rule engine is the interesting part. So this is the part that uses Caraf, and what it does, it basically orchestrates the workflow. So it knows which steps it needs to perform to basically complete the request and then respond to the user with a response. So the engine would run the rules, figure out what it needs to do, and then going to send an event to work executors. So work executors are pretty much cloud instances that do specifically the heavy lifting, like the encoding itself, video, audio, inspections, and this is like the biggest, in terms of scale, the biggest part of our system. So once an executor completes its job, it's going to send an event back to rule engine, and then rule engine is going to pick up event and like keep evaluating the rules and see if there is any other job that needs to be done. And once there is no more job left, it's going to send an event back to API, and then API will communicate it back to the user who requested the encode. So what is Rule Engine doing in this picture? It basically orchestrates the workflow execution. There is a bunch of rules, and there is also some data that those rules are applied to, and pretty much it's like a state machine which just moves data from one state to another based on the results of the execution. So another function of the rule engine is we basically provide the runtime for the workflow execution. The rule engine is forward chaining, meaning like we have some input and then we move towards the completion of the goal. and not the other way around, where you sometimes you tell like, I need to do this, and you go figure out all the steps that need to happen for that. And the rule engine is, as I mentioned, is data-driven. Basically, the state is captured in database, and then the project is transitioned from one state to another till it completes. Okay, so this is pretty much what the rule engine looks like. It runs inside Caraf, and there are three major parts. Like so, the workflow engine runtime. This is like the part which is common for each and every workflow, and it's like it's an OSGI bundle, and it does two things. So it exposes a service which is the API is fairly simple, and all it does, you just give it a workflow and say, run my workflow, and it runs it. And the other function of it is to all the common dependencies that would be used by the workflows, they are consolidated in this bundle, and then they're exposed to the workflows, and they then can use it. So the workflow manager, this is the part which is responsible for managing the life cycle of the workflow, and it has two parts to it. One is like dynamic upload of the workflow, and the other one is whenever you start a new Caraf instance, it's going to figure out what are the workflows that I need to run, and it's going to go get all the workflows and start them, and this is how a new Caraf instance is initialized. And those blue circles, those are basically workflows. And this is how they can share resources on the Caraf instance. And this is why they're multi-tenant, because they all run in the same runtime. And the workflows pretty much is the only part that is written by the user. The rest is they don't have to worry about. So what is a workflow? Workflow, again, it's packaged as an OSGI bundle, and it consists of two parts. There are rules and data model, and maybe some workflow dependencies if there is something specific that this specific workflow needs and it's not available at runtime. And there is an option for the user to package them inside their bundle. So rules are basically, it's our custom DSL, and it's written on top of Groovy's AST transformations, and it's very specific to like job that we are doing it's very workflow specific. And we'll see soon why. And data model is basically, you define how do you store the state of your workflow and maybe some results that are going to be produced by the remote function calls or some or calls to other workflows. And it isn't protobuf. So rule DSL, a very brief dive into it. So consists of four parts. Match, you can match basically action, reaction, and error, and I'll go through all of them like really quick. So match, so here is an example of match. Like you can see like video source, video encode recipe, and encoded video. This is like part of data model, and this is basically, you can think of it as a somewhat similar to a select statement, where you say, if things match certain conditions, then I'm going to do some job. And it also selects all of those data objects and make them available inside the action for user to operate on. So this is the action. Basically, what happens here is, for the majority of the time, the user would update their data model to a certain state and then make a request to a remote function. So the last line, encoder.encode, this is going to be a call to a remote function. So at this point, when the call is made, the execution of the rule stops, all the context is getting serialized and persisted, and then once the function completes, the context is going to get deserialized back into memory, and the state of the execution is going to be restored, and it's going to proceed to reaction, and then let user to handle the response of the function. And in case there is an error which happened inside the function, then there's also a block to handle it as well. And a set of rule is pretty much what a workflow is. And this is an example of model, just a prod above that user can define, and this is like free for all, do whatever you want. So RPC, so as we've seen, the call to a remote function just looks the same as pretty much call to any other function, and there is nothing special that you need to do to handle it. You can either call remote functions or you can call other workflows, and then there's also compile time argument check-in, which is not something that's widely available in other serverless functions. And yeah, it's asynchronous in nature because of action and reaction. And I'm going to pass it to Said. That's going to be it for me. And he's going to talk more about specifics of the Karoff and why we use it and how we use it.
So, I'm Said, everyone. So, in the beginning of the talk, actually in Dimitri's talk, we talked about our architecture and how we want to run all these media processing workflows in a multi-tenant environment. And one of the reasons for that was to do some resource sharing and maybe cost saving. So we did some POs. POC in the beginning of the project, we started to use the default class loader, and it works, but there are some negative points about it. It's not as easy. So we did some more research, and we came up with OSGI and the class loading, which is done in OSGI. So, and we thought it's a perfect match for our use case, because we wanted to have separation of concerns. For here, separation of workflows and runtime for ease of deployment and productivity. And we also wanted to run our workflows in the same environment with isolation. And Karoff, as we know, is a wraparound OSGI framework that you can choose your OSGI framework. Flix or Equinox, you can easily change it. And also, there are very powerful tooling around it. So basically, all the complexity of OSGI is simplified when you use Karoff. So in the rest of the talk, I'm going to go through all the stuff that we do at Netflix. So one is how we make a runtime container, how we deploy these workflows to the container, and how do we actually deploy this runtime, and how we scale it horizontally. So in this schema, we can see how our runtime looks like. So we have an OSGI framework, and it supports our runtime bundle and the workflow manager bundle. And also, we can have multiple workflows. And everything is going to be sitting inside Karoff. So, and we also have to integrate this container with Netflix environment. So what we did, we created a base image in the Netflix environment. So internally, we use a tool called Tidus. Just Google it, you can read about it. So we have a base image for Karoff that brings Karoff as a service and supervises it. So that's our base image. And then on top, we have created a Plato image. So this is the first time we are using Plato. This software that we created, the rule engine, we call it Plato. And so the Plato image brings up the runtime and workflow management bundle as a boot service. So if you were here in JB's talk, one way to bring up Karoff is a customized version of Karoff. So you can describe your software using Kara features, and you can bring it up in boot time.
So here I'm describing our software. So we have the workflow manager, which has a dependency on our runtime features. And consequently, runtime features has some other dependencies, which is not shown here.
So you just describe it. Here we are using XML. JB promised that YAML version is going to come up.
I don't know how much better it is. You choose one.
Yeah. No discussion.
Okay.
And then in the feature configuration, what I'm doing is bring up the workflow manager. Workflow manager, to come up, it needs the runtime. So runtime comes up before, and runtime to come up, it needs some other packages, so everything comes up perfectly. So our runtime is ready. Now how are we going to deploy our workflows to this runtime? As George mentioned, we don't want our media experts to be worried about OSGI. Can you imagine how hard that can be? And we really don't want them to be worried about dependency. As Dimitri mentioned, sometimes they have some specific dependencies that we need to bring to the runtime. So how do we handle that? So to achieve this goal, we created a Gradle plugin. As a developer point of view, they just apply one line of code to their workflow, and everything is handled. It creates an OSGI bundle, and it handles dependency in a way that it recursively goes through all the packages in the class path, and it also compares to what is available in the runtime, and basically looks at the diff, and it packages the diff as a private package in the OSGI bundle. One advantage to the system, our bundles will never not be resolved in the runtime. And also, the bundles are super light. So imagine you have a jar file which is less than a megabyte, and we have like hundreds of them. So we package the workflow. How do we deploy it now? And our goal is CI/CD. We have 3 instances of Karov officially. So we have a dev instance. So the way we define it is, user can play in that environment, they can run tests, and they can do whatever they want. And you have a prod instance, which is the prod version of all the workflows. And we also have an integration environment for all these workflows. So integration environment is equal to the prod, but you put your workflow there, so other workflows can talk to it, because the whole system is a microservice. So we have these 3 instances. So user is done deploying the algorithms and coding algorithms. They check in the code, build job runs, and unit tests, and then it will be deployed to the dev instance. They will run end-to-end tests, and if everything is green and good, they will tag it as released. Then it goes to the prod environment, and consequently to the integration environment. And just some advertisements around it. All these pipelines are handled using Spinnaker, but we are not here to talk about the Spinnaker. So now how do we deploy these bundles to all these environments? We talked about it a little before. So we have this workflow manager bundle, which exposes an API that you can basically upload and start your workflows. So it integrates with Netflix Artifactory. So we grab all the bundles from our Artifactory, and we use Karov bundle commands when the artifact is there to install it. And before I go to the next point, so in a microservice cloud environment, there is this term for stacks. So we go one step back. Previously, developers had dev farms. They would reserve a dev farm, and everything was up and running there, and they would go there and run their tests. But now we do it dynamically. I'm assuming a lot of people are doing it too. So
developer says, I want to run everything in this stack, or sometimes they don't just say it. It randomly gets generated, the stack gets generated, everything happens, and there is time to live for it, and it does. So now we have to handle this in a single instance of Kara. How do we do it? Because you know, in OSGI, you cannot have one instance of a bundle with the same version to run next to each other. So to provide support for these stacks, we had to do something. So what we do is, when you want to deploy your workflow to these instances, we do a trick. So we grab the stack that they have provided for the other components, and all we do is to change the bundle name. So the OSGI framework thinks there are different bundles, but basically they are the same thing. So here we have a real example. Packager is a workflow that packages the videos and do encryption for it. So we can see version 141, we have multiple instances of it running for like end-to-end test or every other things without any interference. So we went all the way to how to package the workflow and how it gets deployed to this environment. Now we have changes to our runtime. How do we deploy that? So the first thing for us, in the architecture part, you saw that we have three components. One was the API, one was the rule engine, and the other one the functions. So the first step for us is to run an end-to-end test with the rest of the components to see if everything is good. Then we have to verify that this runtime can run with all the previous active workflows in our prod environment. That's the second one. So if everything is good, we tag this Docker image as release, and that will then be deployed to prod. And then when everything is good and running, we will tag the runtime bundle as release, so workflows will start to depend on it. So first it's available in our prod runtime, then they will depend on it. So there might be a question here. We can say, if the change in runtime is backward compatible, everything is gonna just work fine. But what happens if the change is not backward compatible? I'm sure if you guys use platforms that other teams or people provide to you, you get these emails that there is a dependency change, please go ahead and make changes. Now imagine we have hundreds of workflows from different team at Netflix. Are we gonna just email them and say, go and change it? And they are not software engineers. They are software, but they are media experts. So to know how that works, let's take a look at the OSGI headers of one workflow. So as you can see in this line, so the NMAX is just one workflow that imports packages from Plato runtime. So it imports the workflow comments. And so it has dependency to Plato runtime, but the dependency is provided as a range that you can do, right? So this workflow works from this, .0.0.381 all the way to version 1. So when we bump the version, the minor version, this workflow is not going to get resolved with the new version. So that gives us the advantage to have multiple versions of runtime running next to each other. Again, remember, it's an OSGI environment. So this is a real example that we have two versions of runtime working next to each other. Some workflows are depending on the old one, and some on the new one. And developers even don't know about it. And so what happens is, all these workflows, as we talked about, they are in a CI/CD loop, right? So every 24 hours, they update their dependencies. So they will gradually pick it up, and the old versions will be cleaned up, the old runtime versions. So we went all the way to, how do we make that runtime, how we upload the workflows to it, and how we change the runtime. Now, how do we scale this horizontally? In the beginning, we started to just get some ideas about it. There is this great tool, Apache Seller, that you can use, and it worked fine for us. But our use case is a little different and basically a little simpler. So all we need to do, what we need to do, is to bring up new instances and know what workflows to run. I think Dimitri mentioned it. So our workflow manager bundle can handle that. We have a workflow store that knows what are the status for different workflows, which one is active, which one is not active. So this cold start feature, when CarOff comes up, just loops through all the active workflows in the environment, like prod, INTG, or dev, and brings all of them up. And these workflows are stateless, and they can work next to each other. So all we need to do is to just scale up or down. Auto scale is handled for us by another team at Netflix. So we just say, CPU hits, scale up. Memory hits, scale up. So that was about it. So we learned some lessons in this journey that we want to share. So when you start with it, reflection is just a pain, but you will get used to it. Your class loader is not going to work sometimes. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, in the beginning, we didn't have this cool feature that just handles the dependency. So sometimes you had to just go to user and say, okay, add this package, add that package. The try and error that everyone does in the beginning when they work with OSGI. So this tool just increased our developers' productivity. And the most important thing is, when you get your CarOff instance into your prod environment, environment up and running, it's just amazing. It's pretty stable. And in our dev environment, we have up to 300 workflows running next to each other without any issues. So performance is amazing.
In the same CarOff instance?
Yes, same CarOff instance. And now we are open to questions. Go ahead, please. Go.
I have a question about the workflow bundle. This bundle does not export any package, right? They only use require bundle for Prato runtime,
yeah,
and import package. That's it.
That's it.
Okay.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So, have you evaluated some other open source rolling engines before writing your own? Like
definitely.
Tools? I don't know.
Dimitri can take that.
Yeah, we did. So, well, one of the popular ones is like Drupal. We didn't like it.
That's a good reason.
And not just us, like our. So, as we mentioned, like many times, like our engineers who basically use these workflows, they're media centric. They write like low level C++ code. They have no idea how to write microservices or rules or anything like this. Or how do they, I don't know, they would just forget a closed database connection and they will be hanging out there for forever until Netflix just dies. I don't know. So our goal is to make it simple for them. And one of the things that is inside like this custom rule engine is this built-in asynchronous support of calls to the functions that they write or other workflows that they write, and they don't have to do anything. They just have to like literally inject their function, and it's going to be available for them, and they just call like the method of this object, and it's strongly typed. They cannot make a mistake. This is pretty much our goal. We did a POC with Drupal as well, and it was like very hacky to do all this asynchronous processing. And also the language of the rules themselves is somewhat, that just freaks them out.
So they prefer the straight Ruby.
It looks a lot like Java, and they're a little bit familiar with Java because this is what Netflix has been using for a while. So. it just lowers the barrier, and there is like the whole team of these engineers who don't have to learn all those new things like rules and whatever. And basically the costs of just building this thing are outweigh them learning all those things they have to learn to efficiently build all the services.
So, like, in one craft environment, you might have, like, the same system deployed n-fold, right? Because, like, the set of bundles that represent the system are deployed multiple times, but with different bundle names, right? And so, let's say you were to expose, like, a RESTful service. I don't know if that's what you do in craft or not, or how you talk to it specifically. Or, I guess you use, like, RPC, you're saying?
Yeah.
Let's say you were to choose to start exposing a RESTful service. Then would that not imply that you would have to expose the same endpoint n times over? And then how would you route to it correctly? Right?
Bad won't work. If you try to deploy the same bundle, exposing exactly the same JT endpoint,
yeah,
or even the same CXF endpoint,
yeah,
it would have an issue on the second one.
Exactly.
So what you have to do is, more than changing the symbolic name, because you change the symbolic name, you have also to change to have a configuration for a bundle where you deploy on different endpoints, and you have to use a kind of proxy on top of that that can route depending on the endpoint, for instance. That's why I ask about the export package. Because if you just changing the symbolic name, it's enough in their case, but if they also expose the next, export the package, and we export the same package with same version, you're going to have an issue in the framework. Even if you change the symbolic name. So that's why it worked for them.
So if you remember, Dimitri talked about our API components, which are not running in Kara. So we have APIs for each of those workflows, and they are all Spring apps, Spring Boot apps to be specific. And the way they communicate to us, to the rule engine, it's asynchronous. So you have your own queue, and your stack name is involved in there, so there is no conflict.
Okay. Yeah.
That's a trick.
Yeah. So you guys write it in Groovy, and then Groovy code gets deployed into the craft.
So the Groovy code in compile time is transformed to Java.
Okay, that I didn't know.
Yeah.
Cool.
The Java code.
Right. So then you can write it in Groovy and then just up you go.
Yes.
Nice.
In Listen Learn, you said that one key for the adoption was to simplify the way of creating the bundles for your users. Because first they don't have to have a deep details about how AGI works, plus for them to focus on their business, which is basically the employee. Do you see all the, other than that, other barriers to the Keras adoption in your case? Even in your team, do you have some, did you see some drawbacks when you first tried Keras in terms of packaging, or in terms of tooling, or in terms of development? What's your experience about that?
You want to take it?
I can take it. So it took us some time to basically figure out all the detail because we were fairly new to OSGUI and Keras itself. But if you are a platform team and you have a bunch of clients and you do like whatever Spring Boot does, and then all this overhead of all the operational overhead, it goes to basically clients of your platform. Now we have to figure out, how do I scale my stuff, how do I update all those dependencies, and then if you have a bug in your platform, then you have to go to each of them and just ask them, hey guys, can you please update it, there is a bug, and then they will tell you, we don't have time. Or there is like things like libraries that you use, like Guava, which is not compatible in between versions, and then you have to forever stay on this old version of Guava. And the team which develops this API that we show, they decided to go the paved road of Netflix, and they have to deal with all of that, and we don't, because we we control all the dependencies, and most of them are coming from the runtime, and we decide when we upgrade them, when we update them. And honestly, I would just pretty much update whatever updates is good, whatever is not, I'm just gonna go and fix their workflow and just create a pull request, make them approve it, and that's it. I'm done. I don't have to, like, for half a year or years go and chase them to me.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. I think in the beginning, whoever wants to migrate to OSGI, it is complex because it's a different, you need a different mentality. Karov makes it easier for me, at least did. I think that was the experience. In the beginning, like the way you can adapt to it, it takes time in the beginning.
Right.
I don't know how to fix it, but I think Karov did it, and for our developers, we just removed it. You don't need to be worried about.
I think though that's just like adoption, right? Like I think it's just gotta spread the word, and I think people over time will just be like, oh, like these guys do it, oh, these guys do it, oh, and then people will start being like, well, why are they doing this? And then start seeing, and I think through curiosity, adoption follows.
Yeah,
I agree. I think honestly now we have. Including in the Karov distribution, we add a lot of new examples, examples just to show how you can easily implement some classic use cases. And honestly, Valet is not enough for sure, but Valet is for sure.
Yeah.
And you said that you have a single, today in production, you have a single Karov instance running something like a 300 workflows.
So the 300 is. 300 or more is in the dev environment.
Okay.
And so you have less in the production right now because this whole new system, people are adapting to it. So we have some workflows in the old system and the new ones are coming. Yeah, as of now, we have one single instance. We are ready to scale horizontally.
Yeah, that's actually my question. Do you plan to scale with multiple Karov instances and using your workflow bundle manager?
Yeah.
Because it is the one that will organize and orchestrate the ramp up on different instances. And in that case, it means that the API will call a single endpoint that will proxy to different instances, or? It's a kind of API gateway or something like that.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
They're talking through queues, so it doesn't matter.
Okay.
So each Karov instance running workflows, and workflow is just going to pick up the next message and run whatever is requested. And we are going to go with approach that we currently use for other reasons too, because Spinnaker gives us like automatic auto scaling. We just configure, you know. I want to add instances when I'm out of CPU or I'm out of memory, or and then when there are resources that are not used, it's just going to scale it down. So we get this, and it wasn't too hard to implement. It's very simple, and we hope you like.
Right. So basically, your architecture is already ready to scale because if you are using queuing, or let's say you just send queuing and you have multiple instances with different workflow and they pick it up. And
that's all we need to do is just start another graph.
That's awesome.
And it doesn't matter which workflow, which kind of instance pick it up the next step for the workflow.
That is
they synchronize basically through the queues and the
database.
Another kind of aspect to add is the Karov instance in our system, they never talk to each other, and they don't have to. There's no message in there to communicate along.
Yeah.
That's why we don't use Scala. All the workflow is independent to each other, never communicate. They only communicate it through the API.
Yeah, makes sense.
And then, another reason is when you're in the cloud, your instances, they come and go, and you know, less dependencies.
Yeah, awesome.